My name is Claudia Sherman. I'm 15 years old. Today is December 14th, and I'm speaking with Dr. Leticia Toledo Sherman, who's my mom. We are recording this interview in Santa Monica, California. Okay, so what hardships did you face as an immigrant?
Well, the first hardship that I faced when I came to the U.S. was, entering high school without speaking English, learning a new language at a time when, it was social interactions were important to me. And I came feeling smart, and then all of a sudden I felt really stupid because I couldn't speak the language and most basic things I wasn't able to articulate. So to me, that was one of the most difficult times in my whole life. It was going from feeling that I was smart to feeling that I was stupid just because I couldn't even, you know, ask for very simple things.
Right. Okay. Do you ever regret having left Cuba?
At first I did. I remember having recurring dreams of like going back to Cuba and going and visiting all of my aunts and my uncles and my grandparents, and I felt like this, you know, dream where I just had very little time to kind of see everybody and that I had to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have regrets, but at that moment I did. Early on I did.
Yeah.
No longer.
It could be really difficult to leave your hometown. I feel like my life would be very uprooted if I had just left all at once. And you were around my age when you left, right?
Yeah.
That would be really
hard. I had a very strong relationship with someone who I'm still friends with now. The last night we stayed in Cuba, I actually went to stay in her house because she was my best friend.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
I'm happy to know this about you.
Yeah.
I don't think I had ever known that. You might have told me when I was little.
Yeah,
but
she's my friend who's in Argentina and
Yeah, you've told me about her.
So we were inseparable for like the last 3 years of being in Cuba.
Oh.
And we used to pretend that we were sisters because she still calls me. You know, if you look at my, we're in touch with through Facebook, and she always calls me mi hermanita.
Oh. And did she know about you moving?
Yes, of course. We cried a lot.
Oh. When did you find out that you were going to move?
Well, we knew it a long time because my dad was trying to leave Cuba since I was very little, since I was like 8 or 9. And we always knew that that was going to happen, but we didn't know that it was going to happen. And then just, you know, in the last 2 months before we left, we found out like 2 months before we left. Because my dad got a special visa to leave for Costa Rica. And that was really hard. And I was really upset at my dad. And I cried and I said, you know, this is horrible, and you know, I didn't want to leave. Yeah. And even today he reminds me that, you know, I told him that I didn't want to leave, but
and
it was
so
hard. We had a cat.
You did?
Yeah, we had a cat that we left behind.
Oh.
It's really hard. So
what was the cat's name?
Lanita, or I forgot, Lanita or Motica, something.
Motica. Okay, that's so cute.
Because she was fluffy.
Oh. So when you came to the U.S., what was the worst treatment that you had ever received, like as an immigrant?
Well, honestly, because we came into a community of immigrants, right? We didn't we went to a world that was not America in many ways because it was a Cuban and Hispanic neighborhood in New Jersey. We didn't encounter, I didn't know that many Americans, right? So it was everybody was pretty much on the same boat. I do remember when I started high school, there was a big division between the American kids and the, or even the previous immigrant generation that spoke the language and had been born here, or, you know, and the new immigrants were, you know, kids my age that had just come.
So was there a large community of immigrants? At your high school?
Yeah, it was a large community of immigrants, but there was a distinction between the new immigrants and the old immigrants.
So people like me, who
like you,
her parents were immigrants.
And then they didn't talk to us. They didn't, you know, we were seen as the new kids who couldn't speak English and wore like, you know, ugly clothes because they.
So was it like the bottom of the social classes?
Yeah.
That's
pretty
really
much.
Really upsetting.
Yeah.
I don't think we have that at school based on like immigrational status, but there definitely are other components.
Yeah.
There definitely is a class system
at my school. Yeah. I remember
when
we first came, I was so excited because it was April. We came in April and it was still cold, and we went to a church and that had kind of like a place where you can find like clothes but for
mm-hmm.
free, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like a thrift shop. And we went and we got this, what I feel were beautiful, like, clothes.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, it was, outdated and probably not very fashionable. But for me, because we didn't have anything, that was really exciting.
Yeah.
But that was the clothes I wore for until I graduated from high school. I had very little access to new clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of, embarrassing at when I figure out that, at first I was excited, but then when I figure out what it meant, it was embarrassing, and I was very aware of what everybody else, the other kids were wearing, so that I would try to do the best I could with the clothes that I had.
It's funny because now that's kind of the same people who probably would have made fun of people like you for wearing secondhand clothes, people of that same status are now trying to adopt that, and now they're now thrifting has become like something trendy and
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about that?
I love the fact that you don't want to be a consumer of new stuff, because I really feel strongly against that too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very proud of the fact that you have chosen this path of not being part of the problem,
mm-hmm.
right? You're not interested in consuming just for the sake of consuming. You're interested in you know contributing to good sort of environmental. Yeah, I'm proud of you and your generation, because you're showing what was wrong with our previous generations in terms of consumerism and you know, disregard for how, like, let's say the clothing industry treated the workers, you know, all the waste. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It was completely like ignored.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you guys are not ignoring that, and you're making even the older generation aware of these problems.
Yeah. It's a very conscious trend, and I'm pretty happy that it's come back, because although there are other reasons to like be bullied and be lower in the class system, clothes has kind of been eliminated from it.
Yeah.
Because you won't see anybody wearing like designer clothes.
I also
and stuff.
Think that is a way to be creative, because you're not just, it's very easy to go to a store and get an outfit and have no thinking,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's no you're not involving your creativity. You're just getting somebody else that tells you what's going to look good.
Yeah.
Versus when you go to a thrift store and you see all the different possibilities, and you could get something that's a dollar, and you put it together with something else that's a dollar or two, and you can make something amazing,
right?
And that's a creative process that was not there before. So that's a new thing.
So in a way, the immigrants were ahead of their time with that.
Maybe.
Okay. So you eventually started studying chemistry, right?
Yeah.
So what was it like being a Hispanic woman studying chemistry? Did people ever doubt your intelligence based on, like, stereotypes and prejudice that they had?
You know what? I have to say that I probably was one of the first generations where... So in Cuba, when
mm-hmm.
I grew up in Cuba, gender, like, I never felt that being a woman or a girl and intelligence were in a discordance with each other. On the contrary, it was almost like girls were treated as better in math
mm-hmm.
and sciences because of the fact that we were more disciplined than sometimes boys. So I never had a doubt of myself that I was good at, in math and science. It was strange to me when I came to the U.S. that that was not the case, because I never let it bother me. And in some cases, I was kind of oblivious to it. There's probably a lot of stuff around me, but I didn't, because I didn't come mm-hmm. from that mindset, I kind of wasn't aware. I became aware of it later when I was in graduate school, that there was such a thing as, you know, and you look around and you say, well, oh, you know, it's only like maybe 7 girls in a, and you know, a class of 50. And that's when I really became aware that was a disparity. Mm-hmm. But I had good mentors, and I ended up, after learning English, you know, getting good grades and doing well in science. So it was not a problem for me anymore.
Yeah, that reminds me a lot of the book that we read, Black Boy, because the author, Richard Wright, he was like a very smart person, and he wasn't really aware that African American people were like known as unintelligent and stuff, and he continued to like read and write, and even though he ended up having to leave school multiple times, he was still really smart, and he didn't doubt himself
mm-hmm.
until he became more socially aware
yeah.
of how people viewed people of his kind.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's just really harmful, because people who view themselves as smart and who know that they are smart can completely be destroyed by this system
yeah.
that's just built against them.
Yeah. Yeah, so in many cases, being oblivious of it was helpful to me. I was sort of somewhat shielded because I wasn't aware of the stereotypes that existed,
mm-hmm.
you know. And part of that was because of the fact that I was in sort of a bit of an isolated community. I didn't have a lot of exposure to the larger
yeah.
community. And also, I think being the daughter of immigrant parents, they wanted us to do really well, so they didn't
yeah.
impose. My dad never said, oh, you shouldn't be this and you shouldn't be that. It was like, no, you do whatever will get you ahead, whatever will educate. They wanted us to get educated, and
mm-hmm.
And so my parents never had any, they didn't apply any boundaries to us in terms of like, you know, intelligence, and they were very proud of me
yeah
because I was doing well in school. So that was, I also had a lot of not financial but psychological support from my family.
Yeah. And what did your parents do? How did they get money?
My dad, well, again, as immigrants without speaking the language, my mother used to work at a clothing factory
mm-hmm.
as a bathing suit factory, so she was a sweatshop worker. But she took that job because, because we needed the money, number one, but I also gave health insurance. And then Abuelo had a little construction company. So
mm-hmm.
he like fixed houses and, you know, built houses and do that. So that's how he supported the family. He was a contractor, carpentry, you know, masonry, lots of things you
yeah.
know, related to construction. And that was how he supported our family.
Yeah.
And
I feel they were very proud of you because you were going out and getting an education
yeah. mm-hmm.
and pursuing a much more, like, prestigious
yeah.
career.
Yeah. And they it was always very clear to us that they wanted us to do better than they did. That
mm-hmm.
was clear.
I feel like that's a very universal thing in the
yeah.
community of immigrants. Like, I've seen, like, online, and I've heard other people who are children of immigrants talking about how immigrant parents have very, very high standards for their kids because they want to prove that their kids
yeah.
and that immigrants are just as capable as those who
mm-hmm.
are not immigrants, which
mm-hmm.
I feel is... It's sad that you have to prove that because people believe that the only smart people are the ones who come from the same place
mm-hmm.
as them.
Yeah. And a lot of it is a misunderstanding because of the language, right? When you speak a different language, you're not as eloquent maybe at times. That's misunderstood as not being intelligent or not being smart or insightful. When
mm-hmm.
when you're able to speak the language, you realize that there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of intelligence and a lot of, you know, wisdom in those communities.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're not highly educated, they have, you know, they have a lot. Look, so Abuela wasn't educated, college education, but she read a lot, right?
So and she still does read.
She reads a lot, right? So even though she's not formally educated, she educated herself.
Right.
Right? And my father wanted to be an architect. Abuela wanted to be an architect.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his dream, and he couldn't do it in Cuba. So in the U.S., he became a contractor because that's the closest thing to being an architect, right?
Uh-huh.
So they were living, part of their goal was to live, have the kids be educated because they couldn't be educated
mm-hmm.
themselves.
And was the language one of the reasons you went into a field of like science and STEM, because the English language isn't super involved in it?
I don't think so. I love to read.
Mm-hmm.
I just love science. I went into science because I love science, and I got very early exposure in Cuba. So I started having chemistry classes in sixth grade.
That's so different from us. I'm taking my first chemistry class this year.
In 10th grade. Yeah,
right. Everything before this was just like
I had science. Physics and chemistry and geography, which is a subject you guys don't learn here.
Mm-hmm.
Those are separate subjects for me in Cuba. And we had, like, geography was, like, divided in natural geography and social geography. So we learned these subjects individually. So by the time you graduated from high school, you had maybe 6 years of physics and
mm-hmm.
chemistry and geography and math.
Yeah.
So a lot of, so I did have a very strong education in Cuba. To answer your question, I went into sciences because I really loved sciences.
Mm-hmm.
But I also liked art and reading. So, but I just felt like I was good in math and chemistry. I loved the idea that chemistry was kind of like this mysterious world where you could sort of make new things.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So it's very wrong for people to think that immigrants aren't intelligent, because some could say that you have a better education, like even at an elementary school level, than these Americans did, because you learned so much science. And I'm not saying that like the education systems should be pitted against each other, but it's so wrong for people to say that immigrants are unintelligent just because they don't speak the same language as you.
Exactly.
Because then that means that pretty much, like, the entire world isn't as smart as Americans just because not the entire world speaks English.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everybody is smart. And if I were to go to, like, China or something, and I were to try and find a job, I would not be successful because I don't speak Chinese.
Yeah. So one of the things I noticed, you'd be interesting, when I was
mm-hmm.
in graduate school, there were two levels of kind of brackets. One were the American students,
mm-hmm.
and they were very smart, but they were less prepared than the foreign students. So we had students from India and China.
And you had lots of foreign friends in your your community
and
of PhD people.
Yeah, and a lot of them were way better prepared than we were in the U.S. That's still somewhat the case, that you know, for graduate school is very strong here, but
mm-hmm.
undergraduate is often stronger in other countries.
Yeah.
So when in the sciences, there are a lot of very well prepared foreign students.
Mm-hmm. So who were some of the foreign students that you knew in graduate school?
Well, one of them you've met, Celine.
Celine,
France.
Yeah.
Natasha's mom.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Excuse me.
No, it's okay.
Then we had students from... So Natasha was a friend. There was two other French students that I was really good friends with. Her name was Helene Jusselin. She's a professor
mm-hmm.
at... in Paris now.
Yeah.
And there was another student Boris Vizual, that he's also a professor.
Yeah.
Lots of students from China. Many of them went back to China. That was when during graduate school I met even a lot more during my postdoc years, but
mm-hmm.
The sciences is not dominated by foreign students.
That's really interesting. And where did you go to graduate school?
I went to graduate school at State University of New York in Stony Brook. Mm-hmm. That's where I got my PhD in organic chemistry.
Yeah.
And then I spent 4 years there doing a field called studying physical organic chemistry and
mm-hmm.
material science to create materials that in many cases are of the type of that are used in the cell phones. The screens of cell phones
mm-hmm.
are based on the type of science that I did for my PhD.
And how does that translate to what you're doing now, which is medicinal
yeah.
chemistry?
Yeah.
Because I don't think cell phone screens and like medicine has much in common.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a very interesting thing. So it's true, that has nothing in common, but the major sort of tools and components of my education, I recombined them.
Mm-hmm.
They were all pillars of something called structure-based drug design.
Yeah.
So what it's we needed to study organic chemistry, organic synthesis. We needed to use computational chemistry, design the materials, and then we had to do crystallography, which is the study of what those materials look like, what the structures of those materials. Those are exactly the three components that are part of something called structure-based drug design, which is how you design drugs to
mm-hmm.
be specific for protein structures or targets of disease. So
mm-hmm.
when I went to my postdoc, I realized that I could use the three components of my education and reshuffle them and refocus them to make medicine and drugs. So
mm-hmm.
that's how it was a conscious decision to change my field, and instead of continuing in material sciences, which is the field that I was in,
yeah.
I was much more interested in finding, medicines for people, like designing medicines for
yeah.
diseases. So that's how I refocused my career, and that's what I've been doing since I left my postdoc years.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard you say stuff about if you ever had to go back to university, you'd study like marine biology, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn a lot about like animals and biology in Cuba?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of strong science very early on.
Yeah.
I loved the natural world, and being from Cuba, it was being an island.
Yeah.
The sea was very part of my life, always part of my life. So when I went to graduate school, the marine biology department got a big grant, so they went to the chemistry department where I was, and they gave us a presentation and about all the research that was going on
mm-hmm.
at this research institute, and they had a big ship that they would go on sea
yeah.
for months at a time to collect data, and I imagine how much fun it would be to do that, but it would have taken my I would have sort of had to take a lot more classes.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point I decided to just continue my path
chemistry.
To chemistry, which I really like, but
mm-hmm.
I love the idea of marine biology.
Yeah. Do you feel you gravitated towards chemistry as a kid, or was it something that you chose later on?
I think I always loved the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
I loved picking up, I remember thinking, pretending that snails were, actually, I didn't know that snails were alive during my time. I thought they were prehistoric.
Yeah, you thought you were, a little archaeologist.
Yeah, so I love picking up, snail shells and other natural things and pretending that I was, an archaeologist. Science was always part of, even my, when I was sort of playing alone as a kid, It was sort of part of my pretense. I wasn't pretending to like be dressing up dolls. I was pretending to be a scientist, a field scientist. So that was, you know, there from the beginning in many ways. And then because sciences were very a big emphasis of Cuba, right, because they wanted to make the country a developed country, I definitely got a lot of exposure. So that's kind of how I gravitated towards chemistry. I was a chemistry, something called, I don't know how to translate, maybe it's called a, like, teacher's assistant, monitor. They call it monitora de química.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to, like, fix the glass room, the storeroom, and see all the glassware and, you know, like, really kind of have fun with all the different types of equipment that were there.
Yeah. That sounds really fun. I don't think they'd ever trust kids like me. I don't think they'd ever trust kids to do that at my school. So, yeah, I feel like you and I were very similar in some ways, but I don't know if I could ever pursue chemistry or science as a career.
Well, actually, but I'll tell you one thing that's different. So I liked art, and I took art also in school as a kid, but my parents didn't want me to go into art.
Yeah.
Where I'm actually happy to support you if art is what is going to make you happy as a adult, I'm happy to support you. I don't think that I had an option with that because my parents probably would have convinced me not to go into art. Or they did actually convince me not to go into art because they felt that you couldn't get a career, you wouldn't make a career out of being an artist, right?
But didn't Abuela like paint murals or something?
Abuela painted murals. She was very talented. My school had murals that were painted by Abuela. And one day maybe when you go, when I went to Cuba in 2001, I went to see them and they were still there.
I
don't know
to
if
see
it's
them.
Still there, but you can go and see them and maybe they're still there, but.
Well, that's a career out of art, so.
Well, she did it as a volunteer because they had parents had to do volunteer, a lot of volunteering. It was mandatory volunteering, so you know here, parents have to, well, they don't have to, but, you know, many parents get very engaged in school volunteering.
Yeah.
In Cuba, during the time that I was a kid in Cuba, it was mandatory, so all the parents had to volunteer. That was how Abuela did it. I don't know if that's the case anymore, but.
I'd like to see those murals. Yeah. I hope they're still up. That would be so cool because she's a very artistic person.
Yeah.
And whenever she visits, I always see her little like doodles on stuff. And she brings her little coloring books.
Yeah. So something about Abuela and art. So Abuela was offered a scholarship to a very famous school called San Alejandro in Cuba. But it was in Havana. And my grandfather didn't want to go, let her go, because I was, you know, in her time, he didn't want her to, like, leave the family and go study on her own alone. So she wasn't allowed because of, and, you know, my grandfather, I don't think he meant bad. It's just that that was the time.
She was needed at home?
No, it was. It was just like, you know, like morally, you don't send your woman child alone to go live in another city.
That makes sense.
And so my mother got married at 19. So instead of going away to school, she got married and had kids.
I wonder how, like, your life and my life would have been different if she had went to that school.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe she would have met, she wouldn't have met my father.
Oh, but I love people.
So that's it, yeah. You love people. He's so cute.
He really is. I'm excited for them to come visit soon.
Yeah. In second week of January.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'll tell you one thing that interesting. So when I became very aware of the disparities of of gender and science was when I was doing my postdoc at MIT, there were two women in the lab of 23 men.
Yeah.
There was one graduate student, and she was a Japanese, young Japanese graduate student, and myself. So for 1 year, there were two, a graduate student and myself. She graduated, and then we ended up getting another German postdoc.
Was this a woman or a man?
A woman. Yeah. It was about 23, like 20-something students, and there were usually 2 to 3 women in the lab at any time. And it really was, but my advisor was also very supportive, right? It was never an issue of like feeling like he was treating the male graduate students better or postdocs better than us.
Yeah.
But I became aware of how uneven the numbers were, right?
Yeah.
And besides that, my graduate school professor, his wife had gone through a lot to become a scientist woman.
Oh, she was a scientist as well?
Yeah. Yeah. She spent 18 years as a postdoc because she couldn't find a job as a professor.
Yeah.
Because she was a woman.
Wow.
Her name is Joanna Fowler. She's a super smart woman. And my advisor used to make fun, and he would say, she's the smart one in the family, but I'm the one that got the job.
Uh-huh.
And that's really telling that in the times in the 60s when they both got their PhDs, there were not a lot of opportunities for female faculties in the physical sciences like chemistry to get academic jobs. So she ended up being a postdoctoral researcher, something that you typically do 2 to 3 years. For 18 years, because they were married and he had a position already, and there were no opportunities for her, even though she ended up doing amazing work and becoming super famous on her own rights. But most of her work was done as a postdoc with very little salary.
That's so crazy.
But the nice thing, I was very fortunate that my advisor made me and my other female graduate students very aware of that situation. So it was not, you know, we didn't take it for granted that we were able to get a PhD in chemistry and women in the generation earlier had it so much more difficult.
And I think science is still quite a male-dominated field.
Yeah, but more so chemistry. I think biology is very well represented now, which is really exciting. When I go to a conference, I look around me, and I'm, as you know, I'm doing more neurobiology and medicinal chemistry now, right? And neuroscience.
Yeah.
And in those fields, there's probably equal numbers. And in some cases, when you look at the younger, when I look down at the younger generation, I often see more women than men.
Oh, that's really great.
Yeah, it's really great. And science and biology, like life sciences, is very, very well represented by women.
And how do you you've worked for this organization that helps with like Chicana women in science. What's it called?
It's called SACNAS.
SACNAS?
Yes, it's Society for the Advancement of Chicana and Native American Scientists. So I am a mentor to them. I also have a profile as a role model to the students because they are not, there's not a lot of representation of scientists, women, Latina scientists, women, they want to highlight those examples of women like myself that have broken barriers. So I volunteer for this organization and trying to mentor students. Sometimes I help them organize their thinking about how to present their science, how to present themselves, how to pursue, you know, careers and feeling like they actually have choices and that they can make good, that they can pursue their dreams, but also make them aware of how to present their data and how it is important to, like, you know, present yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a world that's often not well represented by Latina women, especially.
Yeah, that's a huge accomplishment to be able to say that you're like a mentor for this program, that you're one of the people that all these girls look up to. That's like really crazy.
Thank you.
Wow. I look up to you.
Yeah, thank you, sweetie. That's really sweet. It just came to me. I one of the things that, so I'm definitely really interested in outreach, but what I've also, I have used my career to do something that I feel is fundamentally good for society and for humanity. And I feel that's driven me, and by having that drive me, people have become aware of my work,
mm-hmm.
and how I represent a role model. It hasn't been that I have actively gone out to become a role model, which I'm definitely much more aware of it, but it was just by following desire to do something, you know, fruitful and meaningful. That came as a gift to me.
Okay. Thank you so much for letting me interview you, Mama. This was great.
Thank you, sweetie.
Okay.
I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
Love you.